أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين Verse number 34 يا أيها الذين آمنوا إن كثيرا من الأحبار والرهبان ليأكلون أموال الناس بالباطل ويصدون عن سبيل الله والذين يكنزون الذهب والفضة ولا ينفقونها في سبيل الله فبشرهم بعذاب أليم O you who have faith, indeed many of the scribes and monks wrongfully eat up the people's wealth and bar them from the way of Allah. Those who treasure up gold and silver and do not spend it in the way of Allah, inform them of a painful punishment. Now this is one of the most controversial verses of the Quran. You might just read it and you might not find it controversial at all, and you might find it completely plain, simple and very straightforward. However, there are issues in this which has raised controversy among the exegetes, and also which has raised lots of conflict among the companions of the Prophet at the beginning, to the extent that some of them wanted to change some part of this verse and were of course resisted by others. Now we'll see why this verse is as such. Okay, first of all, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is actually giving a good rebuke to people like myself, because Ahbar and Ruhban are the scribes and monks, the clergy of Jew and Christianity, Judaism and Christianity, and also of course we can then take it for clergy of Islam, because there's no difference. So many monks and scribes, Ahbar are of course the clergy of the Jews, and Ruhban, the monks, are the clergy of the Christians. Many of them, they wrongfully eat up the people's wealth. يَأْكُلُونَ أَمْوَالَ النَّاسِ بِالْبَاطِلِ As I said before, anything you read in the Quran about Jews and Christians, then you can somehow extend it to Muslims, to see whether we are acting in a similar way or not acting. So you can put many scribes, many monks, and many ulama, of course, if we extend it to the Muslim time, are wrongfully eating up the people's wealth. Now, what does this mean? This is very difficult actually to explain. What does this mean? They eat up the wealth of people, bil-batil, not in the right way. Of course, taking money from someone, not in the right way, not in a way which is allowed in religion, which is prescribed in the ordinary way of transactions and exchange of money, is batil. For example, riba is eating up money in batil, because it is not a prescribed way of taking money and property from people. Now, what do the clergy do? The monks and the scribes, and if we extend it to our time, what do? That they eat up wrongfully the property of people. Now, you might say that okay, they take. Let's speak about our own religion, because we don't know about how other religions they take money. It's something similar. Say, for example, in Islam, we take zakat, or homes from people. Now, this homes and zakat is not really meant to be spent by the clergy, as we know. It is meant to be spent on other issues, and we give homes and zakat to the clergy so that they spend it on our behalf for right purposes. So, homes and zakat is not something that the clergy would eat up, therefore, we couldn't say that they eat people's property in batil. In Christianity, of course, there are lots of endowments, lots of donations given to the church, and lots of regular payments. As well, the church would spend it on religious issues and matters. Of course, there are some salaries. In Islam, we don't have salaries given to clergy, but in Christianity, we have salaries given to clergy. In Judaism, I don't know, I'm not sure whether they receive any salary, the clergy, they receive any salary from the central institution or establishment of religion or not, but in Islam we don't have such a thing. Now, of course, when we study in Hawza, in seminaries, we receive some money just to continue with our subsistence, with our living, which is, of course, if you really, really want to become a clergy and you want to live a good life, I do not advise it to go and study in Hawza, because that's miserable. The type of money that you receive for your sustenance is so little that you're always either in debt or you're always in hungry or something like that. Okay. Now, is this type of receiving money for studying, eating people's money, which is khums money usually, is it eating it in barter? Certainly not, because people have to study, some people have to go study, learn about the religion, come and warn other people, teach other people, and we have to, of course, sustain them. This is our duty. It's a people's duty to sustain these people. So this couldn't be eating people's money in barter. Well, in other religions as well, they have to go and learn. And when they are learning, they have to be sustained. And when they are sustained, of course, this is not eating people's money in barter, not in the right way. So what really it means, eating people's money in barter, not in the right way? Now, usually the exegetes say, since in the past days the judges in all areas were among the clergy, in Islam you know that it's only one or two centuries that the courts are separated from religious institutions. Previously, the judges were always from among the clergy. It was only the clergy who judged people, who judged in courts. In other religions, it has been the same, especially in Judaism. Usually the exegetes say this means to take bribe from people, to rule according to the desire of one party against the other in battle, not in the right way. This is a good meaning, of course, that you go to a monk, you go to a scribe, you go to a clergy, you want them to judge in a case, and they might take some money from one side to judge wrongfully, and this is eating money in battle. And therefore, إِنَّ كَثِيرًا مِّنَ الْأَحْبَارِ وَالرُّهْبَانِ, many of monks and scribes and clergy, they eat the people's money in barter. Well, however, judging is not the outstanding duty of the clergy. The duty of the clergy is actually to preach, to bring people closer to God. People are usually ignorant. People usually forget about God. The duty of clergy is to preach them, to bring them closer to God. And although they do other things, they judge, they might teach or any other thing, but the outstanding duty should not be forgotten. So when we say many monks and scribes, they eat up the people's money in the wrong way, it should have something to do with their main duty, which is preaching. Allama Tawatabai rahmatullah alayhi has a special view on this. He says that a clergy, whether it's a monk or a scribe of Jews or a Muslim clergy, usually what they do, they are living on, of course, these acts of preaching. Of course, it's not good when you want to go and preach to say that I want some money. But usually, when you go, when you preach, when your life is immersed in this type of business, it's not a business, of course, in this type of activity, then, of course, you receive money from people. They pay you for different reasons. Maybe they pay you because they think that anyone else spending some time on this, they have to pay, or whatever. And of course, it's not haram to receive this. It's not illegal to receive this. However, if instead of bringing people closer to God, you take them farther away from God, if you behave in a way that people are saying, people would say that, okay, if this is the man of God, then you don't want to be man of God. If this is how God is, if this is how the prophet is, if this is how the people close to God are, then we don't want to be close to God. In fact, driving people away from God. And still you are a man of God. Still you are a clergy. Still you are a monk. You are a priest. You are an alim or whatever. If this is the way that you behave, then whatever you receive from people is barter. And many of clergy, this is of course, this verse is very rebuking for the clergy, whether Muslim clergy or Jew clergy or whatever. Many of these clergies are devouring the property of people, not in the right way. Bilbata. And, you can judge this, say for example, with Christian clergy. You see, the establishment of the church is a very, very detailed establishment, very deep-rooted, very wealthy establishment, many endowments, many donations are given to the church. However, you see that in the past centuries, the church, instead of taking people towards God, it has driven people away from God. The way the priests, the Christian clergy, have behaved has caused, you might say that what have they, or they might say, what have we done? We don't know what have they done, what has happened. But we see that in the past century, people have been driven away from God. They have left church. They have left faith. They have no faith anymore. People, especially in Christian countries, they have no faith anymore. Probably 60-70% of them have no faith. 90% of them don't go to church at all. So what has happened? Well, first of all, they have explained the tenets of religion wrongly. They have made a theology which is not tenable, which is not understandable, which people cannot take in, and people have left it. They have behaved in a way that people have become reluctant to go near them, and many other issues. So, all these money which goes to the church, well, could we say according to this verse that is actually devoured or eaten up in the wrong way, bilbat. What about the Jews clergy? Of course, we have rabbis, we have high standing clergy among the Jews. Well, of course, and they receive lots of donations and endowments. But what have they done? They have barred other people to come to Judaism. They have stopped them. They do not preach Judaism to other people. It's something among themselves. And then, of course, many other issues that we know about. Are they devouring people's money bilbatil? Well, certainly. Now, about Muslim clergy, you have to judge. I shouldn't judge, because I'm a Muslim clergy myself. I cannot judge whether we are devouring people's money bilbatil or not. But, of course, we have to be very careful. And you have to remind the clergy that they have to be careful. If you see that there is some fault there, it's not only acting in the wrong way, it is even preaching in the wrong way. If you talk about God in a way that people's hearts would become reluctant, if you teach about your prophet, your imams, in a way that people say, this is rubbish, we cannot take it, we cannot understand it, then of course you have taken people away, driven people away from God. And therefore, this is a very, very dangerous responsibility if someone wants to take upon themselves. Okay, so إِنَّ كَثِيرًا مِنَ الْأَحْبَارِ وَالرُّهْبَانِ لَيَأْخُلُونَ أَمْوَالَ النَّاسِ بِالْبَاطِلِ وَيَسُدُّونَ عَنْ سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ. Now, this is more severe. And they bar them from the way of Allah. Now, of course, this is something which goes certainly with clergy of the previous religions, that when people wanted to come to Islam, they stopped. They said, no, you shouldn't leave your religion. This is a battle religion. Islam is not a right religion. You shouldn't go. So they stopped people from going to, and of course nowadays as well. Now you can say in a way that all clergy of other religions, since Islam is the culmination of the true religion of God, all other religions are, the clergy of other religions are barring people from coming to Islam. They are actually disheartening them. They discourage them to come to Islam. That is in a way barring people from the way of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So it's right to say wa yasudduna an sabilillah. They are barring people from the way of God. والذين يكنزون الذهب والفضة ولا ينفقونها في سبيل الله فبشرهم بعذاب أليم. Those who treasure up. Now, this is very interesting because the verse says والذين and those who treasure up, and you see in this very beautiful translation the verb and is dropped. It says those who treasure up. It means it's describing the clergy who were acting in that way. Those who treasure up gold and silver and do not spend it in the way of God, inform them of a painful punishment. Now, should it be and those who treasure up gold and silver, or those who treasure up gold and silver? Now, you might say, what's the difference? وَالَّذِينَ يَكْنِزُونَ الذَّهَبَ وَالْفِضَّةَ, and those who treasure up gold and silver, or الَّذِينَ, those without that waw. Now, if that conjunctive, if that waw is there, it means that, okay, there are clergy who do that, and there are other people who do other things. So, and those who do these things, both of them are going to have the same punishment. However, if the waw is not there, then it means that those clergy who were acting in that way, devouring people's wealth in the wrong way, those are the ones who are treasuring up gold and silver, and therefore inform them of a painful punishment. Now, this verb, of course, very easily and very simply is dropped from this translation. However, there were people who were ready to give their lives to make sure that this verb is in place here. Now, the reason is, why is the reason? Now, I just want to mention one hadith. It is reported in hadith that when they were actually recording this verse at the time of Uthman, when they were writing it down, you know that the Quran was written at the time of the Prophet, peace be on him. Many, many versions of the Quran were written by different companions, and of course they had their own style of writing, and they made some mistakes in writing the Quran. And the copies of the Quran that went out to different parts of the Muslim land, some of them had some mistakes in them. So at the time of the Caliph Uthman, in the third decade after the demise of the Prophet, in the third decade, the Muslims decided, all the companions decided, and they advised, including Amirul Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib, they advised the third Caliph that he should make a unique copy, a united type of writing of the Quran, and burn all other copies and send this one united copy, which was called Nuskhatul Imam, the leading version, the version which actually would be the standard version of the Quran, send it to other to all parts of the Muslim land. And they did it. Of course, it was done by two of most scholarly companions of the Prophet, Zayd ibn Thabit and some others, and under the supervision of certainly Ali ibn Abi Talib, Amirul Mu'mineen, and everyone was actually looking after that no mistake would take place when they were writing that leading version of the Quran at the time of Caliph Uthman. Now, one of the issues which happened was when they were recording this verse, the people were coming and advising that this waw should not be here. You have to drop it. Now, Al-Ba'a ibn Ahmar is one of the Tabi'is. He reports that إن عثمان بن عفان لما أراد أن يكتب المصاحف أرادوا أن يلقوا الواو التي في البراءة. When Uthman was recording this leading version of the Quran, the people came and they said, this waw should not be recorded. It is not here. And قال أبي, my father, Ahmad, he said, لَتُلْحِقَنَّهَا أَوْ لَأَذَعَنَّ سَيْفِي عَلَىٰ آتِقِ. You either put this waw here or I take my sword and fight with you. And of course they knew that if they were going to drop this waw from here, then a great war would have started. So فَأَلْحَقُوهَا, they recorded the waw here. Now what difference this would make? Now the difference would be, if the waw is not here, the whole issue would go back to the clergy of Christianity and Judaism, to monks and scribes. So it says, many of the scribes and monks wrongfully eat up the people's wealth and bar from the way of Allah. Those, of course, those clergies, those monks and scribes who hoard up treasure, silver and gold, and they do not give it away or spend it in the way of God. So it's very simple. It's all about scribes and monks, Christians and Jews. What about Muslims? No, this is not about Muslims. Now, why they didn't want this waw to be here? Because many companions of the Prophet had actually compiled, had collected lots of wealth, which no one could count. And if it came to the judgment of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, saying that those who treasure gold and silver and do not spend it in the way of Allah, if it was going to, of course, include the companions of the Prophet, then it was a pity. And of course, it was going to be something which the companions or Tabi'un or whatever, they didn't like to hear. So they didn't want this waw to be here. Now, one of the people who was insisting and actually bringing this waw to attention of Muslims, that you should not treasure up gold and silver, this is going to have a great punishment, you have to spend it in the way of God, was the person who is known to all of you, Abu Dharr al-Ghifari. He was killed because of this. He was deported because of this waw here, because he was always bringing this waw to attention of Uthman bin Affan, other companions, and especially to the attention of Muawiyah. There is a hadith reported in Bukhari from Zayd ibn Wahab. He said, you know, Abu Dharr was very sensitive about the poor people. He himself was a poor man. He didn't want anything for himself, of course. But he was unhappy about what had happened after the Prophet, peace be upon him. I think I spoke here about the wealth, the type of wealth and the amount of wealth which was gathered by some of the companions, like, for example, Sa'd ibn Abi Waqas, like Zubair bin Awam, like Talha, like others. They had hoarded the type of wealth which was unprecedented in that area. And the reason was because Islam had conquered wealthy countries. They had conquered Iran with its wealth, they had conquered Egypt with its wealth. Golds and silvers were flowing from everywhere to Medina. And what they did with it, of course, the companions had a right to take a special portion of it. And of course, Uthman bin Affan was very generous in this regard. It is reported that when one of the companions passed away, Abdul Rahman bin Auf, very famous companion, his wealth, because they wanted to distribute the wealth among the heirs, the gold and silver that he had, they brought it to the court before Uthman. And as a bad coincidence, at that time, Abu Dharr went to see Uthman bin Affan. You see, these coincidences are always very funny. I mean, Uthman, Abu Dharr was in the wrong place at the wrong time, and that was why he was deported. He went there, he saw that a pile of gold and silver is there in front of Uthman, and he said, what is this? He said, this is the, may God have mercy on Abdul Rahman bin Auf, he has passed away, and this is his gold and silver. Of course, as well, the cattle, the land, and all those things, they were not countable, really, how much wealth he did have. And they had passed this gold and silver in a way that Abu Dhar couldn't see Uthman. It was like a wall. And he said, what's this wealth? He said, this is Abdul Rahman ibn Auf's inheritance to be given to his, to be divided among his children. And Uthman, Abu Dhar said, did Abdul Rahman come hold all these gold and silver? Did you not hear, did he not hear the verse, وَالَّذِينَ يَكْنِذُونَ الزَّهَبَ وَالْفِضَّةَ, those who treasure gold and silver and do not spend it in the way of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Now, Ka'ab al-Ahmar, who was a Jew himself, converted to Christianity, and he was a great scholar. There's no question about his scholarly capabilities. He was a scholar when he was a Jew, he converted to Islam, he was a scholar, and he was very close now to the court of Uthman. He said, at that time, he said, this verse is about the scribes and monks, not about the Muslims. Because it says, many of the scribes and monks, they eat up the people's money in a wrong way. And, the, well, you drop the and. Those scribes and monks who treasure up, who treasure the wealth, the gold and silver, and they do not spend it. Abu Dhar was very angry, very angry. And in a way that he had a stick, he just hit Ka'ab al-Ahbar's head with the stick and the blood came. He said, you Jew are going to explain our Quran to us. When from? Now, of course, Abu Dhar was an angry man. Okay, it wasn't right what he did, hitting Ka'ab al-Ahbar's head with his stick. But he was an angry man. And Uthman immediately, of course, Uthman was very clever, immediately sensed that this is going to be trouble. Abu Dhar, who could say anything to Abu Dhar, the closest, one of the closest companions of the Prophet, hitting Ka'ab al-Ahbar, someone converted to Islam very recently, and now explaining, giving exegesis of the Quran to them, and this is going to make trouble. He immediately said to Ka'ab al-Ahbar, forgive him for my sake. And Ka'ab al-Ahbar said, okay, I forgive him. Because then if he wanted to do qisas or to take money, Abu Dhar didn't have any money, he should have been imprisoned or something, so just forgive him for money. Now, Ka'ab al-Ahbar said, this is about Christians and Jews, not Muslims. And Abu Dhar insisted, no, there is a vowel here, there is a conjunctive. And he said, and those who treasure gold and silver. So, this is about Muslims as well. Now, in Bukhari, the hadith is as such. It says that, قَالَ مَرَرْتُ عَلَىٰ أَبِي ذَرْ بِالرَّبَضَةِ. Now, after this incident, Abu Dhar was deported to Sham, to Muawiyah. Now, another mistake of Uthman bin Affan. Because he should have been deported somewhere else. Of course, since Muawiyah was very powerful and very clever, Uthman deported Abu Dhar to Sham, to Muawiyah, so that he take him into task. Somehow he disciplined him. So, however, when he went to Sham, he was a respected companion of the Prophet, and he saw that Muawiyah had built a palace. And this was not, of course, something to be stomached by Abu Dhar. So every morning he went in front of the palace, and he started to shout, this is not what Prophet wanted, you shouldn't build a palace. And Muawiyah wrote to Uthman that if you want Sham to remain in order, please take Abu Dhar back. I cannot hold him here, I cannot keep him here. And then Abu Dhar was taken back in a very terrible situation and he was deported to Rabada. Now Rabada was a place where Abu Dhar was born. And it was a place where in his childhood, he had worshipped idols. And it was the most hated place on the earth for him. And since he hated what he had done in his childhood, worshipping idols. And in fact, when he came back to Uthman said, what should I do with you? You are just taking the order and discipline from my country. So he asked him, where is the most hated place on the earth, in your opinion? He said, Rabat, where I was born. He said, okay, I deport you there. He deported him, and he deported Abu Dhar to Rabada, and he died there, alone. A lonely man. Abu Dhar was a lonely man. And the hadith of the Prophet who said, may God have mercy on Abu Dhar, he lives alone, he dies lonely, and he raises up lonely. And, well, he lived alone, we know that, he dies lonely. How he is going to be raised up again lonely, we don't know, inshallah, we'll see. We'll see that how Abu Dhar is alone on the Day of Judgment as well, treated specially by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So he was deported to Rabada. Zayd ibn Wahab said, I passed by Abu Dhar in Rabada. It's about, I think, 70 miles from Medina. I wonder if one of you have been taken to Rabada. Some tours would take people to Rabada when they go to Hajj. I asked him, فَقُلْتُ مَا أَنْزَلَكَ بِهَذِهِ الْأَرْضِ, what had made you to end up in this land of Rabada? قَالَ كُنَّا بِشَامِ, he said, we were in Sham. Of course, he was deported to Sham first, to Syria. فَقَرَأْتُ وَالَّذِينَ يَكْنِزُونَ الذَّهَبَ وَالْفِضَّةَ, I used to recite this verse, those who treasure gold and silver. Of course, he did it in a very provocative way. We should be fair. He did it in a very provocative way, going in front of the palace of Muawiyah. Anyone wanting to go in, coming out, he started to say, وَالَّذِينَ يَكْنِزُونَ الذَّهَبَ وَالْفِضَّةَ, well, who is this? It's Muawiyah, of course. So he said, I used to recite this, وَالَّذِينَ يَكْنِزُونَ الذَّهَبَ وَالْفِضَّةَ, وَلَا يَنْفِقُونَهَا فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ, and they do not spend it in the way of God, فَبَشَّرْهُمْ بِعَذَابٍ أَلِيمٍ, inform them of a great punishment. فَقَالَ مُعَاوِيَةَ مَا هَذِهِ فِينَا هَذِهِ فِي أَهْلِ الْكِتَابِ, Muawiyah used to say that this is not about us, this is about Ahlul Kitab, this is about Jews and Christians. Of course, dropping the wall, this would be about Jews and Christians. And I was saying, no, it is in about them and about us, and this disagreement caused me to be deported to this land. And it is also reported from in Tafsir al-Qummi, in our books of Exegesis, that every morning كان أبو ذر الغفار يغدو كل يوم وهو في الشام. In Sham, when he was in Sham, every morning he used to go in front of the palace, فينادي بأعلى صوته, and he started to cry, shout with his loudest voice, بشر أهل الكنوز, inform the people of treasure, بكين في الجباح وكين في الجنوب وكين في الظهور. I will explain this later on because we haven't come to this. So this is the case. Treasuring gold and silver. Now, what does this mean? Because if this is the case, many of us, of course I exclude myself in this first place, but many of us have lots of treasure, lots of wealth. Shouldn't we have wealth? Is Islam limiting wealth at all or not? Is there any limit on having property in Islam? Well, what we have actually in our jurisprudence is that there is no limit on the amount of wealth that a person could have. And therefore, you could have billions of pounds and dollars and no one could tell you that this is wrong. If, of course, it has come from a right source, if it has come from right transactions, right business. Now, this is why this verse, apart from that wealth which we discussed, has put many exegetes and many jurists in trouble. What does this mean? Now, there is a hadith reported from the Prophet, peace be upon him, that usually most of the exegetes go in this line. And I would, inshallah, mention Allama Tabatabai moves in another line. They report a hadith from the Prophet that كل مال لم يؤد زكاته فهو كنز. If you have a property and you don't pay the zakat for it, then it is treasure. And it will be included in this verse, you will be included in this verse that you are informed of a great punishment. So usually the treasure is something that people, it was something, now we don't have much of this. We usually put our money, our property in banks. At old days, people, well, there were no banks. There were gold and silvers treasured, hidden under the ground, under the earth or wherever. Usually it was hidden money, something which was hidden. This is what is called treasure, actually. Now, the Prophet said, any wealth, to whatever extent, the zakat of which is not paid, is treasure. وَإِنْ كَانَ ظَاهِرًا, although you do not hide it, although it's quite clear for everyone that you have this amount of money, if you don't pay zakat for it, it's treasure. And therefore, you are included in this verse. وَكُلُّ مَالٍ أَدَّيْتَ زَكَاتَهُ فَلَيْسَ بِكَنْزٍ وَإِنْ كَانَ مَدْفُونًا فِي الْأَرْضِ. And every money, property, you do not pay, you pay the zakat for it, then it's no treasure anymore. Even if you hide it, even if you put it under the ground or whatever, if you have paid the zakat, it's not treasure anymore. Now, Jubai is one of the greatest exegetes. He said, this is ijma', consensus of all scholars, that yes, if you have property, if you have paid the zakat, it's not treasure anymore. If you have not paid the zakat, it's treasure. And you are included. But zakat is how much? 1/10? 1/8? It's nothing actually. Of course, zakat is different from khums in the sense that when you have paid the khums of a property, that property has no khums anymore, as long as you have it. But zakat, for zakat, you have to pay every year, 1/10. But however, 1/10 every year is not going to consume much of that property if it is huge. Okay. And this is why Ali ibn Abi Talib has actually given another opinion about that. He says that there is a report from him who says that مَا زَادَ عَلَىٰ أَرْبَعَةَ آلَافٍ فَهُوَ كَنْزٌ. Whatever exceeds 4,000. Now, 4,000 dinar or 4,000 dirhams, we don't know, because dinar is 10 dirhams. So, if it's dinar, it's 40,000 dirhams. It's not huge wealth. It was much. I mean, you could buy a big house at the time of Ali ibn Abi Talib with 80 dinars, or say 800 dirhams. So, you can judge what type of wealth this would be, 4,000. He said, if any money goes above, is under 4,000, and you have paid the zakat for it, it is not kanz, it's not treasure. And whatever is above that, it is treasure. Well, this is putting a limit on the type of property that Muslims could have, isn't it? And this is against the whole jurisprudence of Islam. I mean, if we want to go to this according to this hadith, that would make issues very difficult. It means that you couldn't have more than 4,000 dirham or dinar. Okay, it's ambiguous. We take the higher limit, we take 4,000 dirham. Say, in our time, it might be 40,000 pounds. No, more than that, 400,000 pounds, say, for example. Okay. If you have above that, then that's not your money. And if you keep it, if you do not spend it on the way of Allah, you are, of course, informed of a great punishment. Now, this is against our jurisprudence. What then would be the right opinion? Now, Allama Tabatabai had a special view in this. It's very interesting to know that Allama Tabatabai is a type of unique person who has very, very special ideas on issues which is not accepted by many people, of course, especially by many jurists. But he's an exegete, he gives his own opinion, and of course a philosopher, a scholar of social sciences, he has done lots of studies on this. He says that, okay, we don't say that you shouldn't have more money, but two conditions. First, you should not hide whatever you have from the government. This is the first condition. The second is that whatever you have above this 4,000, is your property tentatively. It's your property provided there is no need for it. Now, spending in the way of Allah, of course, that's another question. That what does it mean, spending it on the way of Allah? I think our time is running out, and I don't think I can pull this discussion to an end in this short time. So just mentioning very quickly what Allama says, and then we leave the conclusion for next week, inshallah. What is the meaning of spending in the way of Allah? Well, we'll discuss it later on, inshallah, next week. But he says, you shouldn't hide whatever you have if you are very wealthy. And the authorities, the Islamic government, so to speak, they have a right that if need arises, if there is, say, for example, a big famine, if there is a big calamity, if there is a jihad that they have to provide for, any need, they have the right to take this money from you. And this is infaq fi sabilillah. You have to give it. Because sabilillah is whatever that strengthens the cause of God and also providing for His creatures, for His people. So you can spend this money in any way you want. It is your property. Whatever goes above that 4,000, whatever the limit is, and we have to somehow make a type of comparison about that 4,000 dinar and the property that we might have now. He says, whatever goes above that, it is your property so long as there is no need for it in the society. If there is a need in the society, and by need I don't mean that there is one person coming to you and telling you that I need. No, that's ordinary type of infaq you do. Whether you have above 4,000 or you have less than that. But in big occasions, say for example, this tsunami has come and a very, very wealthy man in Indonesia, he can somehow support the calamity, the people stricken with the calamity, very easily with his property. If there is an Islamic government, if they see that they have to take this property and spend it there, you should not object, and you cannot object. This is not your treasure. This is the wealth which is on the earth for the sake of the people. It is now in your hand. You use it so long as there is no need. If there is a need, then you have to give it up. And the authority that takes it up from you is, of course, the Islamic government that would take it from. This is the opinion of Allama Tabatabai. Of course, there are bits and pieces here that should be explained. Inshallah, we'll continue with this next week. Wa sallallahu ala Muhammad wa ala
Thank you, Shaykh. We should start with the discussion.
I hope none of you have treasure to ask me difficult questions about gold and silver.
If you just for a moment put away the fixed side of it completely, if a person has a great deal of wealth and it refuses or doesn't spend it in the way of Allah, and even if he's perfectly entitled to it, if you ask yourself why would he do that, it's because he's attached to it. There cannot be any other reason. And from a spiritual sense, coming to your classes that you do, would that not be the painful punishment for him in the Akhirah to remove that attachment from himself? Could that not be very simply what
it's
referring to?
Yeah, inshallah, when we talk about the special punishments, that these gold and silver are going to be heated up on the day of judgment and being actually pressed against their forehead and their back, it is actually. They cannot detach from it. And this is something which is going to fall upon them on the day of judgment. Yes, yes, that's right. Yeah.
I'm not sure if it's completely related to this, but with regard to what the gentleman just said, and also with regards to hoarding money, but not necessarily hoarding it. I don't know if we can put a figure on it, but saving it because for the future you may need it. Now that can amount to quite a lot depending on what your current living status is, whether you live very comfortably or not. But I was wondering Islamically how that was seen. I don't know if you can relate it to Yusuf having 7 years of saving for 7 years of famine.
Well, of course, this 4,000 which is mentioned here, as I said, is quite a big money, and I don't think you could have spent 4,000 in 4 years in 7 years. So the savings that usually we have. I exclude myself again. The savings that usually we have wouldn't go up to these type of wealth which are regarded to be treasure. It is something which, as I said, the type of wealth that some of the companions had hoarded after the Prophet, which was really uncountable in some occasions, and the type of money that usually the billionaires have and they wouldn't spend it. Ordinarily, what usually ordinary people have is not counted to be treasure. However, yes, if it goes to exponential figures, then of course, according to Allama Tabarakallah, not according to mainstream jurisprudence in Islam, according to him, there is a limit on it. And it is in your hand tentatively. Yeah.
Assalamu alaikum.
You know,
you mentioned, and maybe you're going to answer this next week, you mentioned the concept of zakat, and you mentioned the hadith that said that if the Prophet said that if you have paid zakat on that, that is not considered treasure, and if it's not considered treasure, then this would not apply. But today, we see that in our jurisprudence, the concept of zakat is very restricted to those items that were there, gold, silver, cattle, land. And in reality, because wealth is not stored, or is not measured, or is not kept, in those terms, it's in different forms. And as far as I know, zakat is not applying to that. How do we deal with that issue? Because the concept of zakat is still there. It's mentioned in the Quran, it's mentioned in jurisprudence. So then, basically, there's this other issue that even if you take that limit, right, of 40,000 and below 81, if zakat is not paid because it is not practical or it is not jurisprudent, whatever the case may be, then how do we deal with that?
I don't know. Yeah, this is a difficult problem, especially in Shi'i jurisprudence. Sunni jurisprudence has actually somehow included the today's property in zakat, but Shi'i jurisprudence has not yet included that. Still speaks about gold and silver, which is not used. And since our fuqaha are very scrupulous that they go according to what has come in hadith, they say, okay, money is not gold and silver. It's printed money, it's paper, it's credits actually, it's not gold and silver. Very recently, some of the jurists have put forward the idea that yes, gold and silver is not mentioned for the sake of it. It's mentioned because it was a means of transaction, and therefore, today money which has a credit of gold and silver in the central bank, of course, is the same thing. If you ask my opinion, of course, I'm not a jurist, I mentioned this, but according to the standards, yes, money should be included in the items that we have to pay zakat for. However, our jurists are not yet convinced about this. And this really, really poses problem. It brings disorder in the social, economical type of system of an Islamic state or an Islamic setup. And therefore it is, I think, you who have to press the fuqaha to solve this, because really, really it's a problem that money is not included in those items on which we have to pay zakat.
Just, do you know
Allama
Tabatabai, when he has made
exchanges
of that verse about zakat, has he said anything that is...
Allama Tabatabai usually mentions, I am not a Jewist. So...
Did he mention anything about zakat? What is his interpretation? I just want to see there was, if you had...
I don't remember now what he says under this verse of zakat. Usually when he comes to very detailed jurisprudential discussions, he says that for this you have to go to jurists. He usually doesn't mention himself anything. However, in this issue he has come with a very, very clear and outspoken type of idea that yes, above this is not your property completely, it's half your property. Half property is for the people that they will take it from you if there is a need. Yeah.
Just making a point that Allah had sent the Quran, it quite clearly said that the ayat of God tafsir is the other ayat. In Surah Al-Nahl, ayat 71, وَاللَّهُ فَضَّ بَعْدَكُمْ عَلَى بَعْدٍ فِي الرِّزْقِ and so on. He says, those who I gave them more, why they don't share it with the others? Do they deny the blessing of Allah? Maybe that would be kind of interpreting for the other ayat, Surah Al-Tawbah.
Yeah, of course, this is the rightest way of explanation of the verses. Maybe the exegetes or the jurists, they don't see the verse in Surah Nahl explaining the verse in Surah Tawbah in a way that would make the property above a limit eligible. And unlawful for the people to have. But certainly the best way of explanation and interpreting the Quran is to go to other verses of the Quran.
You mentioned very briefly that one of the functions of the clergy some time ago was to be elected as a jurist, and over a period of time this function has been taken away from them or has been given up by them.
As a judge. Yeah.
If this has happened, maybe you can explain how this came about. And if this has come about, hasn't this role been taken away from them or been given up by them led to people going away from God? You explained that how the clergy take away people from God.
Yeah.
Does this not fall in that sort of category? And if it falls in that sort of category, how can we go back to it?
Well, actually, this happened during centuries where governments wanted to somehow put their courts and their judicial system in order. So instead of going to religious legislations in different issues, they started to legislate judicial laws in detail. And then, of course, there were experts of those judicial systems who were not clergy. They went to universities, they studied it, and nowadays, of course, the judges, they don't study religious jurisprudence or law, they study the common law, they study the civil law. They are experts in that, but they are not religious. They might not believe in God at all, but they are experts in the law and they will become judges. So this was a type of government authority which decided to separate the judicial system from the religious establishment. To some extent it was right. I mean, if you go to the Quran is very critical of the way the clergy actually handled judgments and the way they took bribes. I mean, it is especially, the Quran is very critical about the Jew clergy, that they were judges and they were used to take bribes. Suht, which is mentioned in the Quran, وَيَأْكُلُونَ السُحْت أَمْوَالًا يَأْكُلُونَ أَمْوَالًا نَاسَ بِالْبَاطِلِ and they eat suht, which is the bribe in judgment. Maybe we can say that the way they handled it, they really deserved that this should be taken away from them. And how it could go back to them, well, you don't, that's another story. We don't know really how we have to go about it.
Something?
The point that I'm trying to understand is that by giving up this role of judge and then having these two different systems, one is a secular and the other one is a religious one, by giving up this role, has not people gone away from religion and more towards a secular sort of ideas? And the importance of the religion and the getting closer to God, that
element has not been compromised by giving up this role or taking away this role from the religious or clergy. This is what I'm trying to understand. It is, yes, it would make the society more secular, but the fault or the blame would go on, of course, both sides. First of all, the shortcomings of the religious establishment to create a viable and a just judicial system. And the other is, of course, the insistence of government authorities to take this away from the clergy, making a separation between them. The blame, I think, should go on both sides. And if it wants to come back, in Iran, of course, certainly, the authorities are trying to bring back the judiciary to religion, into the fold of the religious establishment. It is not complete, of course. Not all judges in Iran are clergies, and there are other routes of study for people to become judge other than going to have religious studies. But it is very difficult, because judgment is something which usually puts a person in danger. Because usually you have to judge between rich and the rich and the poor. This is what usually happens. You have to take the right of the poor from the rich. And the rich has money and can buy you. And if they do this, of course, the judgments would be impaired. And, well, the clergy, especially of other religions, I don't talk about our own religion now, didn't come up very successfully from this test.
I just want to go back to this 4,000 figure mentioned by Imam Ali al-Islam.
Yeah.
My question is just conceptually, I'm a little bit surprised that Imam would mention an absolute figure.
Yeah.
Considering that figure is in a particular denomination, and for years to come there will be different currencies, and there will be currency fluctuations, and there will be inflationary factors, etc. And obviously he made a statement not only for the people of that time, but he made a statement for the people to come forever. I mean, that hadith that Sheikh wrote is absolute. It's the first time I've heard this figure of 4,000.
Mm-hmm.
Because although you mentioned it is equivalent to about 40,000 pounds,
no, I think it's much more than that.
Yeah. I mean, it has to be if inflation is 2.5%, then it is 1.25 squared 1400 times 4,000. And if they agree, and they are talking about millions, they are really talking about millions. But I'm not worried about those figures. I'm just saying conceptually, for Imam to mention an absolute sum,
When we come to hadith of the Prophet or to hadith of the Imams, we have to know that we are dealing with two types of statements. One are very general statements which are constant in all times. The other is what they mentioned for their own times. I think Shahid Sadr, rahmatullah alayhi, has explained this in his book Our Economy very clearly, that many of such ahadith which mention figure are actually about the time that these people lived, because as you said, the currencies are different, the fluctuation of the market, also the inflation, all these things would count. And what we have to say is that the Islamic authorities the Islamic government should put a limit at any time according to the needs of the society. Say, for example, nowadays the government, and it might change, I mean, every other year. Nowadays, for example, the authorities might say that if you have more than £500 million, for example, okay, then whatever it sees that, it is in your hand, but we might take it one day from you. So the figure is something which goes back to the time of the Imam alayhi salam and what he saw as the right figure for people to have in their hand as their confirmed property, and above that to be something that could be used by the government.
Sisters? Sheikh, talking about Abu Dhar, the way he was acting at that time, supposing he was to do it in a similar way, acted against then a sort of Muslim ruler, he might be regarded as a fanatic. And then the other thing is that
Abu Dhar was a fanatic, actually.
How did Imam Ali react the way Abu Dhar was?
Imam Ali certainly didn't want to oppose the authority. And I mean, it would be very interesting if we could once analyze the way Imam Ali reacted to all these issues which happened in his own time when he didn't have the authority. He certainly didn't want to oppose the authority, so he didn't object that Abu Dhar to be deported. However, what we have in Nahjul Balagha is that Uthman has forbidden anyone to see off Abu Dhar when he was being deported out of Medina. And when this happened, of course, when Imam Ali heard that he was being deported, he took Hassan and Hussein alayhi salam with him. And the three of them, they went to see him off. And of course, the guards came forward and they said that you have no right to see off Abu Dhar, this is forbidden. And of course, Amirul Mu'minin said, go out of my way or otherwise you know what would happen. And of course, no one could stand this type of threat from Ali ibn Abi Talib. So they left him alone. And it is reported in Nahjul Balagha that while he was seeing Abu Dhar off the Medina, he mentioned a few things to him. And one of the most famous statements is that, Ya Abu Dhar, Ya Abu Dhar, إِنَّكَ غَذِبْتَ لِلَّهِ فَرْجُ مَنْ غَذِبْتَ لَهِ. O Abu Dhar, you became angry for the sake of God. So be hopeful in your Lord for whom you became angry. And then he mentions, Ya Abu Dhar, don't worry if you are being sent to Rabaza, because if the heavens and the earth are tightly closed its doors to a person, it means everything comes within the person, then that person has taqwa. Allah would put away in front of him. And then he recites this verse of the Quran, وَمَنْ يَتَّقِ اللَّهِ يَجْعَلْ لَهُ مَخْرَجًا وَيَرْزُقُهُ مِنْ حَيْثُ لَا يَحْتَسِبُ. A very nice statement made by Amirul Mu'mineen. The sympathy was there. However, the opposition to the authority, Amirul Mu'mineen never did it at the time of the caliph. The last verse. Whoever fears God has taqwa of God, Allah would put away in front of him in difficulties and hardships, and would sustain him, would provide for him from a place or from a direction which they would never count on. They would never think. This is verse number 2, a part of verse number 2 of Surah Talaq, Surah number 65.
Any sisters,
Muhammad Ba'al, Allah.